Jindabaw said quietly and with careful lack of emotion, I am a scholar, yes.
Oh, you am a scholar. Don't we speak outlandish new? And cannot I see that you be one or am one?
He ducked his head in a mocking bow.
Being as you be, small and weazened and pale and upnosed.
What is it you want of me, Hamishman? Said Jindabaw, unmoved.
I be titled Rufirant, and Carol be my previous.
His accent became noticeably more Hamish. His R's rolled throatily. Jindabaw said, What is it you want with me, Carol Rufirant?
And how be you titled, Scholar?
Does it matter? You may continue to call me Scholar.
If I ask, it matters that I be answered, little up-nosed Scholar.
Well, then, I am titled Steward Jindabaw, and I will now go about my business.
What be your business?
Jindabaw felt the hair prickling on the back of his neck. There were other minds present. He did not have to turn to know there were three more Hamishmen behind him. Off in the distance, there were others. The farmer smell was strong. My business, Carol Rufirant, is certainly none of yours.
Say you so,
Rufirant's voice rose.
Mates, he says his business be not ours.
There was a laugh from behind him, and a voice sounded.
Right he be, for his business be bookmaking and pewter rubbing, and that be not for true men.
Whatever my business is, said Jindabaw firmly, I will be about it now.
And how will you do that, wee scholar?
Said Rufirant. By passing you.
You would try. You would not fear arm stopping?
By you and all your mates, or by you alone? Jindabaw suddenly dropped into thick Hamish accent.
Are you not for the line?
Strictly speaking, it was not proper to prod him in this manner, but it would stop a mass attack, and that had to be stopped, lest it force a still greater indiscretion on his part. It worked. Rufirant's expression grew lowering.
If fear there be, book boy, thou'rt the one to be full of it. Mates, make room. Stand back and let him pass, that he may see if I be feared alain.
Rufirant lifted his great arms and moved them about. Jindabaw did not fear the farmer's pugilistic science, but there was always a chance that a goodly blow might land. Jindabaw approached cautiously, working with delicate speed within Rufirant's mind. Not much, just a touch, unfelt, but enough to slow reflexes that crucial notch. Then out and into all the others, who were now gathering in greater numbers. Jindabaw's speaker mind darted back and forth with virtuosity, never resting in one mind long enough to leave a mark, but just long enough for the detection of something that might be useful. He approached the farmer cat-like, watchful, aware, and relieved that no one was making a move to interfere. Rufirant struck suddenly, but Jindabaw saw it in his mind before any muscle had begun to tighten, and he stepped to one side. The blow whistled past, with little room to spare. Yet Jindabaw still stood there, unshaken. There was a collective sigh from the others. Jindabaw made no attempt to either parry or return a blow. It would be difficult to parry without paralyzing his own arm, and to return a blow would be of no use, for the farmer would withstand it without trouble. He could only maneuver the man as though he were a bull, forcing him to miss. That would serve to break his morale, as direct opposition would not. Bull-like and roaring, Rufirant charged. Jindabaw was ready, and drifted to one side just sufficiently to allow the farmer to miss his clutch. Again the charge. Again the miss. Jindabaw felt his own breath begin to whistle through his nose. The physical effort was small, but the mental effort of trying to control without controlling was enormously difficult. He could not keep it up long. He said, as calmly as he could, while batting lightly at Rufirant's fear-depressant mechanism, trying to rouse in a minimalist manner what must surely be the farmer's superstitious dread of scholars, I will now go about my business. Rufirant's face distorted with rage, but for a moment he did not move. Jindabaw could sense his thinking. The little scholar had melted away, like magic. Jindabaw could feel the other's fear rise, and for a moment. But then the Hamish rage surged higher and drowned the fear. Rufirant shouted,
Bites, scholar be dancer. He do duck on nimble toes and scorns the rules of honest Hamish blow for blow. Seize him, hold him. We will trade blow for blow, then. He may be first striker gift to me, and I will be last striker.
Jindabaw found the gaps among those who now surrounded him. His only chance was to maintain a gap long enough to get through, then to run, trusting to his own wind and his ability to dull the farmer's will. Back and forth he dodged, with his mind cramping in effort. It would not work. There were too many of them, and the necessity of abiding within the rules of Trantorian behavior was too constricting. He felt hands on his arms. He was held. He would have to interfere with at least a few of the minds. It would be unacceptable, and his career would be destroyed. But his life, his very life, was at hazard. How had this happened? 24. The meeting of the table was not complete. It was not the custom to wait if any speaker were late, nor, thought Shandus, was the table in a mood to wait in any case. Store Jendabal was the youngest, and far from sufficiently aware of the fact. He acted as though youth were in itself a virtue, and age a matter of negligence on the part of those who should know better. Jendabal was not popular with the other speakers. He was not, in point of fact, entirely popular with Shandus himself, but popularity was not at issue here. Dolora Delarmy broke in on his reverie. She was looking at him out of wide blue eyes, her round face, with its accustomed air of innocence and friendliness, masking an acute mind, to all but other second foundationers of her own rank, and ferocity of concentration. She said, smiling, "First speaker, do we wait longer?" The meeting had not yet been formally called to order, so that, strictly speaking, she could open the conversation, though another might have waited for Shandus to speak first by right of his title. Shandus looked at her disarmingly, despite the slight breach in courtesy.
"Ordinarily we would not, Speaker Delarmy, but since the table meets precisely to hear Speaker Jendabal, it is suitable to stretch the rules."
"Where is he, First Speaker?"
"That, Speaker Delarmy, I do not know."
Delarmy looked about the rectangle of faces. There was the first speaker and what should have been 11 other speakers, only 12. Through 5 centuries, the Second Foundation had expanded its powers and its duties, but all attempts to expand the table beyond 12 had failed. 12 it had been after Selden's death, when the second first speaker, Selden himself had always been considered as having been the first of the line, had established it, and 12 it was. Why 12? That number divided itself easily into groups of identical size. It was small enough to consult as a whole, and large enough to do work in subgroups. More would have been too unwieldy, fewer too inflexible. So went the explanations. In fact, no one knew why the number had been chosen or why it should be immutable. But then, even the Second Foundation could find itself a slave to tradition. It took Delarmy only a flashing moment to have her mind twiddle the matter as she looked from face to face and mind to mind, and then sardonically at the empty seat, the junior seat. She was satisfied that there was no sympathy at all with Jendabal. The young man, she had always felt, had all the charm of a centipede and was best treated as one. So far, only his unquestioned ability and talent had kept anyone from openly proposing trial for expulsion. Only 2 speakers had been impeached, but not convicted, in the hemimillennial history of the Second Foundation. The obvious contempt, however, of missing a meeting of the table was worse than many an offense, and Delarmy was pleased to sense that the mood for trial had moved forward rather more than a notch. She said, "First Speaker, if you do not know the whereabouts of Speaker Jendabal, I would be pleased to tell you."
"Yes, Speaker."
"Who among us does not know that this young man..." She used no honorific in speaking of him, and it was something that everyone noted, of course. "Finds business among the Hamish continually. What that business might be, I do not ask. But he is among them now, and his concern with them is clearly important enough to take precedence over this table." "I believe," said another of the speakers, "that he merely walks or jogs as a form of physical exercise." Delarmy smiled again. She enjoyed smiling. It cost her nothing. "The university, the library, the palace, and the entire region surrounding these are ours. It is small in comparison with the planet itself, but it contains room enough, I think, for physical exercise. First Speaker, might we not begin?" The first speaker sighed inwardly. He had the full power to keep the table waiting, or indeed to adjourn the meeting until a time when Jendabal was present. No first speaker could long function smoothly, however, without at least the passive support of the other speakers, and it was never wise to irritate them. Even Prem Palver had occasionally been forced into cajolery to get his way. Besides, Jendabal's absence was annoying, even to the first speaker. The young speaker might as well learn he was not a law unto himself. And now, as first speaker, he did speak first, saying,
"We will begin. Speaker Jendabal has presented some startling deductions from prime radiant data. He believes that there is some organization that is working to maintain the Selden plan more efficiently than we can, and that it does so for its own purpose. We must, in his view, therefore, learn more about it out of self-defense. You all have been informed of this, and this meeting is to allow you all a chance to question Speaker Jendabal in order that we may come to some conclusion as to future policy."
It was, in fact, even unnecessary to say this much. Shandus held his mind open, so they all knew. Speaking was a matter of courtesy. Delarmy looked about swiftly. The other 10 seemed content to allow her to take on the role of anti-Jendabal spokesperson. She said,
"Yet Jendabal," again the omission of the honorific, "does not know and cannot say what or who this other organization is."
She phrased it unmistakably as a statement, which skirted the edge of rudeness.
It was as much as to say, I can analyze your mind, you need not bother to explain. The first speaker recognized the rudeness and made the swift decision to ignore it.
The fact that Speaker Jendabal, he punctiliously avoided the omission of the honorific, and did not even point up the fact by stressing it, does not know and cannot say what the other organization is, does not mean it does not exist. The people of the First Foundation, through most of their history, knew virtually nothing about us, and in fact, know next to nothing about us now. Do you question our existence?
It does not follow, said Delarmy, that because we are unknown and yet exist, that anything in order to exist need only be unknown. And she laughed lightly.
True enough. That is why Speaker Jendabal's assertion must be examined most carefully. It is based on rigorous mathematical deduction, which I have gone over myself, in which I urge you all to consider. It is, he searched for a cast of mind that best expressed his views, not unconvincing.
And this First Foundationer, Golan Treviz, who hovers in your mind, but whom you do not mention?
Another rudeness, and this time the first speaker flushed a bit.
What of him?
The first speaker said, it is Speaker Jendabal's thought that this man Treviz is the tool, perhaps an unwitting one, of this organization, and that we must not ignore him.
If, said Delarmy, sitting back in her chair and pushing her graying hair backward and out of her eyes, this organization, whatever it is, exists, and if it is dangerously powerful in its mental capabilities and is so hidden, is it likely to be maneuvering so openly by way of someone as noticeable as an exiled councilman of the First Foundation?
The first speaker said gravely, one would think not. And yet I have noticed something that is most disquieting. I do not understand it.
Almost involuntarily, he buried the thought in his mind, ashamed that others might see it. Each of the speakers noted the mental action, and, as was rigorously required, respected the shame. Delarmy did too, but she did so impatiently. She said, in accordance with the required formula,
may we request that you let us know your thoughts, since we understand and forgive any shame you may feel?
The first speaker said, like you, I do not see on what grounds one should suppose Councilman Treviz to be a tool of the Author Organization, or of what purpose he could possibly serve if he were. Yet Speaker Jendabal seems sure of it, and one cannot ignore the possible value of intuition in anyone who is qualified for speaker. I therefore attempted to apply the plan to Treviz.
To a single person?
Said one of the speakers in low-voiced surprise, and then indicated his contrition at once for having accompanied the question with a thought that was clearly the equivalent of, what a fool.
To a single person, said the first speaker. And you are right. What a fool I am. I know very well that the plan cannot possibly apply to individuals, not even to small groups of individuals. Nevertheless, I was curious. I extrapolated the interpersonal intersections far past the reasonable limits, but I did it in 16 different ways and chose a region rather than a point. I then made use of all the details we know about Treviz. A councilman of the First Foundation does not go completely unnoticed, and of the Foundation's mayor. I then threw it all together rather higgledy-piggledy, I'm afraid.
He paused.
Well, said Delarmy, I gather you... Were the results surprising?
There weren't any results, as you might all expect, said the first speaker. Nothing can be done with a single individual. And yet, I have spent 40 years analyzing results, and I have grown used to obtaining a clear feeling of what the results would be before they were analyzed, and I have rarely been mistaken. In this case, even though there were no results, I developed the strong feeling that Jendabal was right, and that Treviz should not be left to himself.
Why not, First Speaker?
Asked Delarmy, clearly taken aback at the strong feeling in the First Speaker's mind.
I am ashamed, said the First Speaker, that I have let myself be tempted into using the plan for a purpose for which it is not fit. I am further ashamed now that I am allowing myself to be influenced by something that is purely intuitive. Yet I must, for I feel this very strongly. If Speaker Jendabal is right, if we are in danger from an unknown direction, then I feel that when the time comes that our affairs are at a crisis, it will be Treviz who will hold and play the deciding card.
On what basis do you feel this? Said Delarmy, shocked.
First Speaker Chandos looked about the table miserably.
I have no basis. The psychohistorical mathematics produces nothing. But as I watched the interplay of relationships, it seemed to me that Treviz is the key to everything. Attention must be paid to this young man.
25.
Jendebal knew that he would not get back in time to join the meeting of the table. It might be that he would not get back at all. He was held firmly, and he tested desperately about him to see how he could best manage to force them to release him. Rufiran stood before him now, exultant.
Be you ready now, scholar? Blow for blow, strike for strike, Hamish fashion. Come then, art the smaller, strike then first.
Jendebal said,
Will someone hold thee then as I be held?
Rufiran said,
Let him go. Nah, his arms alane. Leave arms free, but hold legs strong. We want no dancing.
Jendebal felt himself pinned to the ground. His arms were free.
Strike, scowler, said Rufiran. Give us a blow.
And then Jendebal's probing mind found something that answered. Indignation, a sense of injustice and pity. He had no choice. He would have to run the risk of outright strengthening, and then improvising on the basis of... There was no need. He had not touched this new mind, yet it reacted as he would have wished, precisely. He suddenly became aware of a small figure, stocky with long, tangled black hair and arms thrust outward, careening madly into his field of view and pushing madly at the Hamish farmer. The figure was that of a woman. Jendebal thought grimly that it was a measure of his tension and preoccupation that he had not noted this till his eyes told him so.
Carol Rufiran, she shrieked at the farmer, art bully and coward. Strike for strike, Hamish fashion. You be two times yon scowler's size. You'll be in more sore danger attacking me. Be there renown and passion, yon poor spalp. There'll be shame, I'm thinking. It'll be a fair heap of finger-pointing, and there'll be fool saying, yon be Rufiran, renowned baby-smasher. It'll be laughter, I'm thinking, and no decent Hamish woman will be drinking with you, and no decent Hamish woman will be out with you.
Rufiran was trying to stem the torrent, warding off the blows she was aiming at him, attempting weakly to answer with a placating,
Now, Sora!
Jendebal was aware that hands no longer grasped him, that Rufiran no longer glared at him, that the minds of all were no longer concerned with him. Sora was not concerned with him either. Her fury was concentrated solely on Rufiran. Jendebal, recovering, now looked to take measures to keep that fury alive and to strengthen the uneasy shame flooding Rufiran's mind, and to do both so lightly and skillfully as to leave no mark. Again, there was no need. The woman said,
All of you, backstep, look here. If it be not sufficient that this coral heap be like giant to this starveling, there must be five or six more of you ally friends to share in shame and go back to farm with glorious tale of daring do and baby smashing. I have the spalp's arm, you'll say, and giant Rufiran Block pashed him in the face when he was not to backstrike. And you'll say, but I held his fort, so give me also glory. And Rufiran Chunk will say, I could not have him on his lane, so my foremate pinned him, and with the help of all six I gloried on him.
But, Sura, said Rufiran, almost twining, I told Scowler he might have first try.
And fearful ye were of the mighty blows of his thin arms. Not so, Rufiran, thickhead. Come, let him go where he be going. The rest of you to your home's back crawl. If so be, those homes will still find a welcome making for you. You had all best hope the grand deeds of this day be forgotten. And they will not be, for I be spreading them far wide, if you do make me any the more fiercely raging that I be raging now.
They trooped off, quietly, heads hanging, not looking back. Jendebal stared after them, then back at the woman. She was dressed in blouse and trousers, with rough-made shoes on her feet. Her face was wet with perspiration, and she breathed heavily. Her nose was rather large, her breasts heavy, as best Jendebal could tell through the looseness of her blouse, and her bare arms muscular. But then the Hamish women worked in the fields beside their men. She was looking at him sternly, arms akimbo.
Well, scholar, why be lagging? Go on to the place of scowlers. Be afeard. Shall I accompany you?
Jendebal could smell the perspiration on clothes that were clearly not freshly laundered, but under the circumstances it would be most discourteous to show any repulsion.
I thank you, Miss Sura.
The name be Novi, she said gruffly. Sura Novi. You may say Novi. It be unneeded to more say.
I thank you, Novi. You have been very helpful. You be welcome to company me, not for fear of mine, but for company pleasure in you. And he bowed gracefully, as he might have bowed to one of the young women at the university. Novi flushed, seemed uncertain, and then tried to imitate his gesture.
Pleasure be mine,
she said, as though searching for words that would adequately express her pleasure and lend an air of culture. They walked together. Jendebal knew well that each leisurely step made him the more unforgivably late for the table meeting, but by now he had had a chance to think on the significance of what had taken place, and he was icily content to let the lateness grow. The university buildings were looming ahead of them when Sura Novi stopped and said hesitantly,
Master Scowler?
Apparently, Jendebel thought, as she approached what she called the place of scholars, she grew more polite. He had a momentary urge to say,
"Address you not yon poor spalp,"
but that would embarrass her beyond reason. "Yes, Novi?"
"Be it very fine-like and rich in place of scholars?"
"It's nice," said Jendebel.
"I once dreamed I'd be in place, and I be scholar."
"Some day," said Jendebel politely, "I'll show it thee." Her look at him showed plainly she didn't take it for mere politeness. She said,
"I can write. I be taught by schoolmaster. If I write letter to thee," she tried to make it casual, "how do I mark it so it come to thee?"
"Just say, Speaker's House, Apartment 27, and it will come to me. But I must go, Novi." He bowed again, and again she tried to imitate the action. They moved off in opposite directions, and Jendebel promptly put her out of his mind. He thought instead of the table meeting, and, in particular, of Speaker Delora Delarmy. His thoughts were not gentle. Chapter 8. Farm Woman. 26. The speakers sat about the table, frozen in their metal shielding. It was as though all, with one accord, had hidden their minds to avoid irrevocable insult to the first speaker after his statement concerning Trevise. Surreptitiously they glanced toward Delarmy, and even that gave away much. Of them all, she was best known for her irreverence. Even Jendebel paid more lip service to convention. Delarmy was aware of the glances, and she knew that she had no choice but to face up to this impossible situation. In fact, she did not want to duck the issue. In all the history of the Second Foundation, no first speaker had ever been impeached for misanalysis, and behind the term, which she had invented as cover-up, was the unacknowledged incompetence. Such impeachment now became possible. She would not hang back.
"First speaker," she said softly,
her thin, colorless lips more nearly invisible than usual in the general whiteness of her face,
"you yourself say you have no basis for your opinion, that the psycho-historical mathematics show nothing. Do you ask us to base a crucial decision on a mystical feeling?"
The first speaker looked up, his forehead corrugated. He was aware of the universal shielding at the table. He knew what it meant. He said coldly,
"I do not hide the lack of evidence. I present you with nothing falsely. What I offer is the strongly intuitive feeling of a first speaker, one with decades of experience, who has spent nearly a lifetime in the close analysis of the Selden plan."
He looked about him with a proud rigidity he rarely displayed, and one by one the mental shields softened and dropped. Delarmy's, when he turned to stare at her, was the last. She said, with a disarming frankness that filled her mind as though nothing else had ever been there,
"I accept your statement, of course, first speaker. Nevertheless, I think you might perhaps want to reconsider. As you think about it now, having already expressed shame at having to fall back on intuition, would you wish your remarks to be stricken from the record, if in your judgment they should be?"
And Jendebel's voice cut in,
"What are these remarks that should be stricken from the record?"
Every pair of eyes turned in unison. Had their shields not been up during the crucial moments before, they would have been aware of his approach long before he was at the door.
"All shields up a moment ago, all unaware of my entrance," said Jendebel sardonically. "What a commonplace meeting of the table we have here. Was no one on their guard for my coming, or did you all fully expect that I would not arrive?"
This outburst was a flagrant violation of all standards. For Jendebel to arrive late was bad enough. For him to then enter unannounced was worse. For him to speak before the first speaker had acknowledged his attendance was worst of all. The first speaker turned to him. All else was superseded. The question of discipline came first.
"Speaker Jendebel," he said, "you are late. You arrive unannounced. You speak. Is there any reason why you should not be suspended from your seat for 30 days?
"Of course. The move for suspension should not be considered until we first consider who it was that made it certain I would be late and why."
Jendebel's words were cool and measured, but his mind clothed his thoughts with anger, and he did not care who sensed it. Certainly Delarmy sensed it. She said forcefully,
"This man is mad."
"Mad? This woman is mad to say so, or aware of guilt. First speaker, I address myself to you, and move a point of personal privilege," said Jendebel.
"Personal privilege of what nature, speaker?"
"First speaker, I accuse someone here of attempted murder."
The room exploded as every speaker rose to his or her feet in a simultaneous babble of words, expressions, and mentality. The first speaker raised his arms. He cried,
"The speaker must have his chance to express his point of personal privilege."
He found himself forced to intensify his authority mentally in a manner most inappropriate to the place, yet there was no choice. The babble quieted. Jindabal waited, unmoved, until the silence was both audibly and mentally profound. He said, "On my way here, moving along a Hamish road at a distance and approaching at a speed that would have easily assured my arrival in good time for the meeting, I was stopped by several farmers and narrowly escaped being beaten, perhaps being killed. As it was, I was delayed and have but just arrived. May I point out to begin with that I know of no instance since the Great Sack that a second foundationer has been spoken to disrespectfully, let alone manhandled, by one of these Hamish people."
"Nor do I," said the first speaker.
Dullarmy cried out, "Second foundationers do not habitually walk alone in Hamish territory. You invite this by doing so."
"It is true," said Jindabal, "that I habitually walk alone in Hamish territory. I have walked there hundreds of times in every direction, yet I have never been accosted before. Others do not walk with the freedom that I do, but no one exiles himself from the world or imprisons himself in the university, and no one has ever been accosted. I recall occasions when Dullarmy..." And then, as though remembering the honorific too late, he deliberately converted it into a deadly insult. "I mean to say, I recall when Speaker S. Dullarmy was in Hamish territory at one time or another, and yet she was not accosted."
"Perhaps," said Dullarmy, with eyes widened into a glare, "because I did not speak to them first, and because I maintained my distance, because I behaved as though I deserved respect, I was accorded it."
"Strange," said Jindabal. "And I was about to say that it was because you presented a more formidable appearance than I did. After all, few dare approach you even here. But tell me, why should it be that of all times for interference the Hamish would choose this day to face me when I am to attend an important meeting of the table?"
"If it were not because of your behavior, then it must have been chance," said Dullarmy. "I have not heard that even all of Selden's mathematics has removed the role of chance from the galaxy. Certainly not in the case of individual events. Or are you, too, speaking from intuitional inspiration?"
There was a soft mental sigh from one or two speakers at this sideways thrust at the first speaker. "It was not my behavior. It was not chance. It was deliberate interference," said Jindabal.
"How can we know that?" asked the first speaker gently.
He could not help but soften toward Jindabal as a result of Dullarmy's last remark. "My mind is open to you, first speaker. I give you and all the table my memory of events."
The transfer took but a few moments. The first speaker said,
"Shocking. You behave very well, speaker, under circumstances of considerable pressure. I agree that the Hamish behavior is anomalous and warrants investigation. In the meantime, please join our meeting."
"A moment," cut in Dullarmy. "How certain are we that the speaker's account is accurate?"
Jindabal's nostrils flared at the insult, but he retained his level composure. "My mind is open."
"I have known open minds that were not open."
"I have no doubt of that, speaker," said Jindabal, "since you, like the rest of us, must keep your own mind under inspection at all times. My mind, when open, however, is open."
The first speaker said, "Let us have no further..."
"A point of personal privilege, first speaker, with apologies for the interruption," said Dullarmy.
"Personal privilege of what nature, speaker?"
"Speaker Jindabal has accused one of us of attempted murder, presumably by instigating the farmer to attack him. As long as the accusation is not withdrawn, I must be viewed as a possible murderer, as would every person in this room, including you, first speaker."
The first speaker said,
"Would you withdraw the accusation, Speaker Jindabal?"
Jindabal took his seat and put his hands down upon its arms, gripping them tightly as though taking ownership of it, and said,
"I will do so as soon as someone explains why a Hamish farmer, rallying several others, should deliberately set out to delay me on my way to this meeting." "A thousand reasons, perhaps," said the first speaker. "I repeat that this event will be investigated. Will you, for now, Speaker Jindabal, and in the interest of continuing the present discussion, withdraw your accusation?"
"I cannot, first speaker." I spent long minutes trying, as delicately as I might, to search his mind for ways to alter his behavior without damage, and failed. His mind lacked the give it should have had. His emotions were fixed, as though by an outside mind.
Dullarmy said with a sudden little smile, "And you think one of us was the outside mind? Might it not have been your mysterious organization that is competing with us, that is more powerful than we are?"
"It might," said Jindabal.
"In that case, we who are not members of this organization that only you know of are not guilty, and you should withdraw your accusation. Or can it be that you are accusing someone here of being under the control of this strange organization? Perhaps one of us here is not quite what he or she seems."
"Perhaps," said Jindabal stolidly, quite aware that Dullarmy was feeding him rope with a noose at the end of it.
It might seem, said the Larmy, reaching the noose and preparing to tighten it, that your dream of a secret, unknown, hidden, mysterious organization is a nightmare of paranoia. It would fit in with your paranoid fantasy that Hamish farmers are being influenced, that speakers are under hidden control.
I am willing, however, to follow this peculiar thought line of yours for a while longer.
Which of us here, Speaker, do you think is under control? Might it be me?
Tendeball said, I would not think so, Speaker. If you were attempting to rid yourself of me in so indirect a manner, you would not so openly advertise your dislike for me.
A double-double cross, perhaps, said Delarmy. She was virtually purring. That would be a common conclusion in a paranoid fantasy.
So it might be. You are more experienced in such matters than I. Speaker Lestingiani interrupted hotly. See here, Speaker Dendabal, if you are exonerating Speaker Delarmy, you are directing your accusations the more tightly at the rest of us. What grounds would any of us have to delay your presence at this meeting, let alone wish you dead? Dendabal answered quickly, as though he had been waiting for the question. When I entered, the point under discussion was the striking of remarks from the record, remarks made by the first speaker. I was the only speaker not in a position to hear those remarks. Let me know what they were, and I rather think I will tell you the motive for delaying me. The first speaker said, I had stated, and it was something to which Speaker Delarmy and others took serious exception, that I had decided, on the basis of intuition and of a most inappropriate use of psychohistorical mathematics, that the entire future of the plan may rest on the exile of First Foundationer Golan Trevise. Genebal said, What other speakers may think is up to them. For my part, I agree with this hypothesis. Trevise is the key. I find his sudden ejection by the First Foundation too curious to be innocent.
Delarmy said, Would you care to say, Speaker Gendebal, that Trevise is in the grip of this mystery organization, or that the people who exiled him are?
Is perhaps everyone and everything in their control except you and the first speaker, and me, whom you have declared to be uncontrolled?
Gendebal said, These ravings require no answer. Instead, let me ask if there is any speaker here who would like to express agreement on this matter with the first speaker and myself. You have read, I presume, the mathematical treatment that I have, with the first speaker's approval, circulated among you. There was silence. I repeat my request, said Gendebal. Anyone? There was silence. Gendebal said, First speaker, you now have the motive for delaying me. The first speaker said,
State it explicitly.
You have expressed the need to deal with Trevise, with this first foundationer. It represents an important initiative and policy, and if the speakers had read my treatment, they would have known in a general way what was in the wind. If nevertheless they had unanimously disagreed with you, unanimously, then, by traditional self-limitation, you would have been unable to go forward. If even one speaker backed you, then you would be able to implement this new policy. I was the one speaker who would back you, as anyone who had read my treatment would know, and it was necessary that I must at all costs be kept from the table. That trick proved nearly successful, but I am now here, and I back the first speaker. I agree with him, and he can, in accordance with tradition, disregard the disagreement of the 10 other speakers. Delarmy struck the table with her fist.
The implication is that someone knew in advance what the first speaker would advise, knew in advance that Speaker Gendebal would support it, and that all the rest would not, that someone knew what he could not have known. There is the further implication that this initiative is not to the liking of Speaker Gendebal's paranoia-inspired organization, and that they are fighting to prevent it, and that, therefore, one or more of us is under the control of that organization.
The implication is there, agreed Gendebal. Your analysis is masterly.
Whom do you accuse? Cried out Delarmy.
No one. I call upon the first speaker to take up the matter. It is clear that there is someone in our organization who is working against us. I suggest that everyone working for the Second Foundation should undergo a thorough mental analysis. Everyone, including the speakers themselves, even including myself and the first speaker. The meeting of the table broke up in greater confusion and greater excitement than any on record. And when the first speaker finally spoke the phrase of adjournment, Gendebal, without speaking to anyone, made his way back to his room. He knew well that he had not one friend among the speakers, that even whatever support the first speaker could give him would be half-hearted at best. He could not tell whether he feared for himself or for the entire Second Foundation. The taste of doom was sour in his mouth. 27. Gendebal did not sleep well. His waking thoughts and his sleeping dreams were alike engaged in quarreling with Delora Delarmy. In one passage of one dream, there was even a confusion between her and the Hamish farmer Rufirant, so that Gendebal found himself facing an out-of-proportion Delarmy advancing upon him with enormous fists and a sweet smile that revealed needle-like teeth. He finally woke later than usual, with no sensation of having rested, and with the buzzer on his night table in muted action.
He turned over to bring his hand down upon the contact.
Yes, what is it?
Speaker. The voice was that of the floor proctor, rather less than suitably respectful.
A visitor wishes to speak to you.
A visitor?
Jendabal punched his appointment schedule, and the screen showed nothing before noon. He pushed the time button. It was 8:32 a.m. He said peevishly,
Who in space and time is it?
Will not give a name, Speaker. Then, with clear disapproval, One of these Hamishers, Speaker, arrived at your invitation. The last sentence was said with even clearer disapproval.
Let him wait in the reception room till I come down. It will take time.
Jendabal did not hurry. Throughout the morning ablutions, he remained lost in thought. That someone was using the Hamish to hamper his movements made sense, but he would like to know who that someone was, and what was this new intrusion of the Hamish into his very quarters? A complicated trap of some sort? How in the name of Selden would a Hamish farmer get into the university? What reason could he advance? What reason could he really have? For one fleeting moment, Jendabal wondered if he ought to arm himself. He decided against it almost at once, since he felt contemptuously certain of being able to control any single farmer on the university grounds without any danger to himself, and without any unacceptable marking of a Hamish mind. Jendabal decided he had been too strongly affected by the incident with Carol Rufferant the day before. Was it the very farmer, by the way? No longer under the influence, perhaps, of whatever or whoever it was, he might well have come to Jendabal to apologize for what he had done, and with apprehension of punishment. But how would Rufferant know where to go, whom to approach? Jendabal swung down the corridor resolutely and entered the waiting room. He stopped in astonishment, then turned to the proctor, who was pretending to be busy in his glass-walled cubicle.
Proctor, you did not say the visitor was a woman.
The proctor said quietly, Speaker, I said a Hamisher. You did not ask further.
Minimal information, Proctor. I must remember that as one of your characteristics.
And he must check to see if the proctor was a Delarmy appointee. And he must remember from now on to note the functionaries who surrounded him, lowlies, whom it was too easy to ignore from the height of his still new speakership.
Are any of the conference rooms available?
The proctor said, Number 4 is the only one available, Speaker. It will be free for 3 hours. He glanced briefly at the Hamish woman, then at Jendabal with blank innocence.
We will use number 4, Proctor, and I would advise you to mind your thoughts.
Jendabal struck, not gently, and the proctor's shield closed far too slowly. Jendabal knew well it was beneath his dignity to manhandle a lesser mind, but a person who was incapable of shielding an unpleasant conjecture against a superior ought to learn not to indulge in one. The proctor would have a mild headache for a few hours. It was well deserved. 28. Her name did not spring immediately to mind, and Jendabal was in no mood to delve deeper. She could scarcely expect him to remember in any case. He said peevishly,
You are.
I be novi, Master Scowler, she said in what was almost a gasp. My previous be Sura, but I be called Novi Plain.
Yes, Novi, we met yesterday. I remember now. I have not forgotten that you came to my defense.
He could not bring himself to use the Hamish accent on the very university grounds. Now, how did you get here?
Master, you said I might write letter. You said it should say, Speaker's House, Apartment 27. I self-bring it, and I show the writing, my own writing, Master.
She said it with a kind of bashful pride.
They ask, for whom be this writing? I heard your calling, when you said it, that oafish Baintop Rufferant. I say it be, for Stor Jendabal, Master Scholar.
And they let you pass, Novi? Didn't they ask to see the letter?
I be very frightened. I think maybe they feel gentle sorry. I said, Scowler Jendabal promised to show me place of scowlers. And they smile. One of them at gate door say to other, and that not all he be show her. And they show me where to go, and they say not to go else place at all, or I be thrown out momentwise.
Jendabal reddened faintly. By Selden, if he felt the need for Hamish amusement, it would not be in so open a fashion, and his choice would have been made more selectively. He looked at the Trantorian woman with an inward shake of his head. She seemed quite young, younger perhaps than hard work had made her appear. She could not be more than 25, at which age Hamish women were usually already married. She wore her dark hair in the braids that signified her to be unmarried, virginal in fact, and he was not surprised. Her performance yesterday showed her to have enormous talent as a shrew, and he doubted that a Hamishman could easily be found who would dare be yoked to her tongue and her ready fist. Nor was her appearance much of an attraction. Though she had gone to pains to make herself look presentable, her face was angular and plain, her hands red and knobby. What he could see of her figure seemed built for endurance rather than for grace. Her lower lip began to tremble under his scrutiny. He could sense her embarrassment and fright quite plainly, and felt pity. She had indeed been of use to him yesterday, and that was what counted. He said, in an attempt to be genial and soothing, "So you have come to see the place of scholars?" She opened her dark eyes wide, they were rather fine, and said,
"Master, be not ironed with me, but I come to be scholar own self."
"You want to be a scholar?" Gendibal was thunderstruck.
"My good woman!"
He paused. How on Tranter could one explain to a completely unsophisticated farm woman the level of intelligence, training, and mental stamina required to be what Trantorians called a scholar? But Suranovi drove on fiercely.
"I be a writer and a reader. I have read whole books to end and from beginning, too, and I have wished to be scholar. I do not wish to be farmer's wife. I be no person for farm. I would not wed farmer or have farmer children."
She lifted her head and said proudly,
"I be asked many times. I always say nay, politely, but nay."
Gendibal could see plainly enough that she was lying. She had not been asked, but he kept his face straight. He said,
"What will you do with your life if you do not marry?"
Novi brought her hand down on the table, palm flat.
"I will be scholar. I not be farm woman."
"What if I cannot make you a scholar?"
"Then I be nothing, and I wait to die. I be nothing in life if I be not a scholar."
For a moment there was the impulse to search her mind and find out the extent of her motivation. But it would be wrong to do so. A speaker did not amuse oneself by rummaging through the helpless minds of others. There was a code to the science and technique of mental control, mentalics, as to other professions, or there should be. He was suddenly regretful he had struck out at the proctor. He said, "Why not be a farm woman, Novi?" With a little manipulation, he could make her content with that, and manipulate some Hamish lout into being happy to marry her, and she to marry him. It would do no harm. It would be a kindness. But it was against the law, and thus unthinkable. She said,
"I not be. A farmer is a clod. He works with earth lumps, and he becomes earth lump. If I be farm woman, I be earth lump too. I will be timeless to read and write, and I will forget. My head," she put her hand to her temple, "will grow sour and stale. No, a scholar be different, thoughtful."
She meant by the word Gendibal noted intelligent rather than considerate.
"A scholar," she said, "live with books and with I forget what they be name said."
She made a gesture as though she were making some sort of vague manipulations that would have meant nothing to Gendibal if he did not have her mind radiations to guide him.
"Microfilms," he said. "How do you know about microfilms?"
"In books I read of many things," she said proudly.
Gendibal could no longer fight off the desire to know more. This was an unusual Hamisher. He had never heard of one like this. The Hamish were never recruited. But if Novi were younger, say 10 years old... Ah, what a waste. He would not disturb her. He would not disturb her in the least. But of what use was it to be a speaker if one could not observe unusual minds and learn from them?
He said, "Novi, I want you to sit there for a moment. Be very quiet. Do not say anything. Do not think of saying anything. Just think of falling asleep. Do you understand?"
Her fright returned at once. "Why must I do